Hi, it's Grace, and this is Frogmore Stew.
With my heart, yeah. Yeah, my heart belongs to South Carolina. Yeah. That's the place, yeah. That's the place where I want to be.
Spencer Wetmore, welcome to Frogmore Stew.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm a big fan, and I really enjoyed doing some research on you. So you grew up in Charleston. You're a true Charlestonian.
I am, born and raised.
And you went off to a big deal college, Princeton.
I did.
Then you went to law school at Vanderbilt, an attorney, a mom, happily married, and you started your career as a prosecutor in the Charleston County Solicitor's Office.
When I moved back home from law school, that was my first job.
And did you have political goals as you were going through college?
Not at all. If you had asked me 6 years ago if I had political goals, I would have told you no. It was not at all on my radar. After I left the solicitor's office, I went and worked for the city of Folly Beach, and I was involved in local government for a long time. And I really felt like that was a great fit for me. I was able to write ordinances. We did some amazing environmental work and community work and recreation programs. And when this seat came open, people from across political spectrums encouraged me to think about running. And it was honestly the first time I'd really thought about it.
I'm always curious at who the people are that then encouraged them to run. Was it like your family or your friends or... No.
People that are involved in politics, other legislators in local government, but not my coworkers, people that sort of had worked with me and knew that I was interested in issues that mattered to the state. Mm-hmm. And then also some people that were already serving in office. Yeah.
And that seat, it's District 115 down in Charleston, James Island, Johns Island, Folly Beach, Kiowa, Seabrook.
That's
and
right.
That seat came open because Peter McCoy became U.S. attorney. So you ran in the special election. And then was there a runoff?
Yeah. So it was wild. That very first year, it was 2020. I literally announced the week that we learned what COVID was. And I went from what I thought was going to be a very normal campaign to a very weird campaign. We had the primary for the special election and the general election, both on the same day. And I won the runoff by 5 votes. Actually, it was 8 votes for the special and 5 votes for the general. So I guess 3 people changed their votes. But yeah, so don't ever let anyone tell you that every vote doesn't matter.
No kidding. And then you ran again in 2022 and you were reelected by a pretty wide margin.
Even in November of that year, it got a little easier. So that year I won and then again in 2022. So this will be my third sort of regular cycle.
Were you always progressive or did you grow up in a house of parents that had similar views to you? Did something change?
No, I actually grew up in a house. My parents had similar views. I actually don't talk about this a lot, but my stepdad represented Shannon Faulkner when she was the first woman who sued to go to the Citadel. She actually lived with my family. We had like secret FBI patrol at our house. I was probably in middle school at the time. It was honestly a really formative experience in seeing what I'll call the underside of how ugly things can be, which honestly was probably why I was not interested in politics for so long. So I don't talk about that a lot just because I don't know how relevant it is now these days, but my stepdad did educational civil rights his whole career, and my mom has always done land use and heirs property and the kind of things that never made any money but always tried to help people.
I was a college age kid at that time. I was 19, maybe 18 or 19 at that time.
Yeah.
So there were men walking around downtown Charleston with t-shirts on that said the Citadel Bulldogs, 3,221 Bulldogs and one bitch.
One bitch.
And
yep.
I in hindsight, when I look back, at I don't think I understood the importance of it at the time. And I remember most of the people that had opinions on it around me were men.
Yeah.
And that was the driving narrative, was through a man's lens.
Yeah. And I think people forget she was an 18-year-old girl. This was her first time living outside of her parents' house. And she came to pick me up from school one day, and a bunch of my classmates jumped on the hood of her car and started shouting, "Save the male, shave the whale." And you're talking about beating the windshield of an 18-year-old girl and calling her a whale. It's like, really?
Yeah.
And I think that idea of this sort of group mentality, or some people call it a mob mentality, people really do get fired up in a way that when we bring it back down to just human beings having a conversation, they would never act that way. And that's been a really formative thing for me in politics.
And luckily, at that time, social media wasn't around yet, because it would have been way worse.
Yep.
So I guess that leads into, where have we come since then? For women in the state, people in the legislature, both the state House and Senate, only 26 out of 170 are women. That's just about 15%. And yet our state is made up of 52% women. And I feel like representation is so critical in politics. Mm-hmm. The fact that the majority is only represented by 15%, to me, says that we actually haven't come that far.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, in some ways, it's even worse, because especially many of the Republican seats are so gerrymandered. The issues that we
don't even get me started on that, Spencer.
I know. But because of that, we're really catering towards the 7% of South Carolinians who vote in Republican primaries.
And to that point, our state House is 88 to 36 Republicans to Democrats. Our state Senate is 30 to 16. And yet in a statewide election, the difference between Republican voters and Democrat voters is only about 250,000 people out of 2.5 million. And so I think that makes it very clear how badly gerrymandered we are. But I think there are some other things that sort of flow into that, too, that create that situation, which is we don't have public referendums, citizen referendums. Our voting machines, if you accidentally hit straight party ticket and then you go to reverse it, a warning sign comes up like you've done something. And things like absentee ballots, you can only be 65 and older to have no reason absentee ballot, right? There are things like that that all contribute to this outcome, that our legislature is not representative of the people it's representing. And that goes for people of color. It goes for women.
I don't disagree, but just one little plug. 2 years ago, I was really proud that we did bring early voting. So no excuse, early voting. And for 2 weeks before the election, for no reason at all, you can go vote early. So let's hype that up.
Don't you think, though, that's because Republicans have suddenly realized, like, this actually makes more people vote?
It was a bipartisan bill. I negotiated on behalf of the Democrats. My friend Brandon Newton was on behalf of the Republicans, and we came out with a pretty good bill. Imagine that.
So obviously your parents had some impact, but were there other things, like Princeton is a pretty impactful place. I don't imagine you were doing keg stands like I was every weekend in college. You were like doing real smart things.
I've always been really involved with criminal justice work. So that did start in college. I actually founded the Princeton Justice Project Prison Reform. But yeah, I did my senior thesis on restorative justice and this idea of criminal justice reform, and that prisons could be more than just a warehouse for locking human beings away. It could be a moment for rehabilitation, especially the younger you are, the more likely that is to be effective as well. So that's always been a really big driving passion of mine. It's the reason I came to the solicitor's office. I hope that I did some good work. But when you're in it, it's a lot harder to be a force for change than when you're able to be on this level now and looking at it from a structural perspective. I was really fortunate to be appointed to the Pretrial Sentencing Commission, which I hope will be able to replicate some of the work that Charleston County has started in terms of tracking data, looking at how are we prosecuting, how are we making decisions, how are we using discretion. So that's always been a driving passion of mine, and I think it really shapes my view on politics. And then secondly, the work I did in local government, and you start to realize how much zoning laws affect both sides, right? So it affects development and what our communities look like. And it also affects the generational transfer of wealth as a property rights question, heirs property. And you look at how Hilton Head was developed. All of that is generational wealth that oftentimes didn't get passed down to Black families. And Dion Tedder tells this story that there's a South Carolina Supreme Court case. And because the chain of title included a former slave, his family was deprived of that property. And some other family had that generational wealth transferred. It's just, you realize how much property and local government and zoning and land use affects lives.
The heirs property issue is really fascinating and it's awful.
There are definitely reforms that I think Senator John Scott, before he died, had convened that commission. And I think now identifying the next leader for that cause is going to be really important.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you is really about party allegiance, because I do feel like the older generations have become much more allegiant to their party, and the younger generations are much more issue-based. And in the last 20, 30, 40 years, the allegiance that parties have commanded has become stronger. And then Trump is like a thing of his own. I don't really know what that is, but there used to be liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats. Now, anytime that you hear any Republican speak, they have to be like unabashedly pro-life. And I feel like the Democrats can be a little bit more nuanced, but this really goes back to they're talking to primary voters. Exactly. They're not really talking to the general public.
Exactly.
And so if you're running in a primary versus a general, in the primary, you have to be probably more party-centric in your words than when you're running in the general, because when you're running in the general, you really also want to work with those independents and make sure that everyone knows you will represent everyone.
I would say I am the luckiest person in the entire state house because it's like my district was tailor-made for me. I don't really have to say anything I don't agree with. My district very much wants me to be who I am, right? Which is pro-choice, pro-women's issues, fiscally conservative. So when I vote in that way or when I talk in that way, Republicans and Democrats back home tend to agree with me. I really have the same message in the general and the primary. It's about working hard. It's about serving without ego and without the need for credit, because unfortunately, I think that's one of the things that women have to bring to the table. It shouldn't be our job to do it, but here we are. Sometimes we have to be the adults in the room who are willing to not get the credit for something, even though we probably deserve it.
Right.
We have to be willing not to put our name on something because somebody else needs to get the credit in order for it to pass. That message really doesn't change for me. Now, like I said, I'm so fortunate to have the district that I do and to have the voters that I do, because for the most part, my district is a classic Republican swing district, right? It was a 20-point Romney district to a Biden district. And so it's a very classic suburban swing district that wants common sense policies. They want to know somebody is helping them build sidewalks and roads, but not wasting a whole bunch of taxpayer dollars, not going overboard on some of the social things, but also speaking out honestly and clearly about discrimination attempts at the state house. And so I go pretty hard in committee and at the state house on issues like abortion and gun violence, and to largely support from my district.
It's interesting that most Americans would say that they are pretty socially liberal, but fiscally conservative. And I think that the far left progressives would say you can't be both. Typically, what I say when someone asks what my politics are is that I'm socially very liberal, but I'm for effective spending. I want it to have good outcomes. And I think that acknowledging that we have waste is something that Democrats don't do well. And I think that Republicans just go in and say, we need no spending. And so there have to be social services of some kind, but they need to be effective. And I think to your point of when you were working in the social justice system, you get caught in the cycle of what the system is set up to be. So really, you're just like trying to put a Band-Aid on a giant gaping arm wound versus when you get to the legislature, you can actually look what's causing that wound and figure out the best method to stop it from bleeding.
Right.
Versus just continuing to send Band-Aids and hoping that it someday goes away.
Exactly. And that's part of why I feel really fortunate to represent the district that I do, because it's one of the last purple districts. I don't have to really speak to a primary audience. I can say what I believe to be the real truth.
And you have an interesting mix, too, because you have probably at Kiowa and Seabrook an older constituency, and then maybe Johns Island. Those are more like first-time homebuyers, some younger folks. And then James Island, same thing. It's very diverse, too. So you get to speak to everyone.
I represent a district of islands, and so environmental issues really matter. It does skew younger in the population centers, but the most populous areas of my district are James Island and Johns Island. And so being a young mom, which, by the way, only 2% of the legislature are women with school-aged children. I think people can see that I'm in the school fight. I want our schools to be good because my kids go to those schools. The population centers of my district are truly young families. And I think that's probably who elects me every year.
But also, what's the statistic about Kiowa? Aren't the collected taxes from Kiowa something like 50% of our income in the county?
I don't think it's quite that high, but in general, yes. The 6% homes, Kiowa, Seabrook, Folly, Sullivan's, and Isle of Palms, all of them have about 20% full-time residents. That 80% is probably paying for most of the rest of the county across all of our beach towns.
And Kiowa doesn't have services, right?
Like they have their own water district. Their community association does roads. All of those communities are absolutely net positive. They send a ton of revenue into the state and into the county. And all they want are some roads in return.
Give them the roads.
Give them some roads in Johns Island, please.
You mentioned something else that is always a thorn in my side. We have a part-time legislature, and it pays, I think, just over $10,000 a year plus a per diem. So essentially, you have to have another job unless you're a super wealthy person. And that really limits who can actually take that job. Because unless you have a job already that allows you flexibility of where you can work, you can't just leave for 4 months and go to Columbia 4 days a week. It really is limiting in who our representatives are.
Right.
So that's one challenge. And then the second challenge, financially, being able to go out and campaign, being able to be in all of the places that you need to be. If you have little kids, how do you do that?
So the challenge is that most of the events, I want my husband with me knocking on doors, going to community events. It really is a family campaign. Like I said, I grew up in Charleston, so we're fortunate to have parents here. But I would say the number one hardest part of being in office and the number one thing I need more than anything is childcare. And whenever Lola Kate's friends ask me or our neighbors will say, what do you need? What can we do? And I'm like, just sometimes on a Wednesday night, I'm going to call you and I need you to pick Lola Kate up from school and feed her dinner and put her to bed and I will get her at 9:30. And that the childcare piece is the hardest part. And I know you alluded to this, but there are some national organizations out there that have surveyed women and surveyed candidates in general. And one of the biggest barriers is childcare and the expense of childcare and the need for childcare.
We should be launching a campaign to get stay-at-home moms to run for state House and state Senate.
I think it's a huge untapped market.
Totally. And if you go back 30 years to 1992, this is back to where we started, Shannon Faulkner.
Yep.
The state of South Carolina in the state House, 73 Dems to 50 Republicans. In the state Senate, 30 Dems to 16 Republican. Almost the exact opposite of where we are now.
Yeah.
And slowly over time, they pick off 2 seats here, 4 seats there, a few seats here, 4 seats there to where we are now. And now it feels like we're stuck because it's so gerrymandered. There really, as you said, aren't that many flippable or even swing districts. And in 2022, the Dems lost, I think it was 6 or 7 seats in the House. And now it's a Republican supermajority. How do you see the Democrats ever balancing this?
I'll tell you what I think is going to happen. I think the Republican Party is about to cleave itself in half. Either the Freedom Caucus sort of gains the mantle of the Republican Party, or they almost form like a third party. The Freedom Caucus mm-hmm. right now does not caucus with the House Republicans. Mm-hmm. So already, more so than when I first got elected, the Democrat bloc of voters matters. If we align ourselves with the Freedom Caucus on issues like medical marijuana, we can overcome the leadership or the sort of establishment Republicans. I do think the Democrats will pick up some seats this cycle. I think we lost some that we should not have lost last time. And I think there are a couple, especially here down in Charleston, that we can flip back. I also think the Freedom Caucus is going to pick up some seats. And so I think it may end up looking more like a governing coalition than a supermajority in the next mm-hmm. couple of cycles. And I think the more the Freedom Caucus either takes over the Republican Party or competes with the Republican Party, you're going to see the Democrats matter more and more.
And the interesting thing about the Freedom Caucus, traditionally, the state Republican Party has been largely religious conservative-based mm-hmm. politicians. Right. And then there were a few sprinkled in, like the Tom Davises, that were mm-hmm. a little bit more on the moderate side. But it feels like now the traditional Republicans have become really religious and conservative. And then the Freedom Caucus is like the Tea Party of libertarians, exactly. where they may be religious, but they still want no government. And there are these weird intersections, like you just said, of medical marijuana, where the Democrats mm-hmm. are like, oh, yeah, that's freedom. So how does abortion sit with them? Like, that to me is where the line of libertarianism under the guise of religion mm-hmm. gets complicated.
I think there are national organizations out there that have done such, I hate to say this, like this, a quote unquote good job of making abortion, groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom, for example. Groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom, for example, yeah, they exactly. raise millions yeah. and millions of dollars, and then they write the bills that they then come back in and litigate on. So, for example, the abortion bill or the medical ethics bill or the right. quote-unquote savings women's sports, which, by the way, somebody mentioned the Citadel in defending that, and I almost lost it, but I digress. So all of these bills, they find a small nugget of things that people do care about, and then they dramatically make it into this big thing. And then they use all that money that they raise to primary people who don't agree with them. And so probably half of the Republicans that vote for these abortion bills would rather not personally, Freedom Caucus right. or non-Freedom Caucus. But that is one issue where these national organizations have done such work to make it a do or die issue for a Republican voter or elected official in a primary that Freedom Caucus or not, you're going to see every single person vote for this. In the House, William Cogswell was the last Republican who didn't vote for abortion. And of course, in the Senate, as Sandy Sin and the sister senators right, have stood up against it. But in the House, not one Republican. And that's because of the work of these national mm-hmm. organizations that make it such a touchstone issue for Republicans.
How much do you think the national political agenda affects us in South Carolina? It feels like a mm-hmm. lot.
Yeah, way too much. I hate it. Everything gets so nationalized. And all of a sudden, I'm AOC and Hillary Clinton, and they put out mailers where they Photoshop Democrats into, like, pants suits, and they stand us next to Hillary Clinton. And it's just, oh, yeah, Hillary's a great friend of mine. I call her up all the time, and we chat policy. Like, I wouldn't know how to get in touch with somebody in Washington if I tried. The idea that, like, we're all sharing policy is so ridiculous, right? That's the fear factor that sells.
And there is a lot of states' rights talk from the right. And so mm-hmm. you would think that because that's one of their primary platforms, that they would be hyper-focused on the actual issues of the state that are pressing.
Oh, come on. There's no intellectual consistency.
Thank you, Spencer, for that reminder.
Facts don't matter. Hypocrisy is fine.
It's really depressing because there are pressing issues. We are mm-hmm. flooding. Charleston is underwater. Columbia is having earthquakes. Yep. There is stuff that's happening all over the state. And because the environment to so many people doesn't exist, that's where national politics comes in here. And you're mm-hmm. like, no, walk outside during a rainstorm. You're underwater. Yeah.
And to everybody listening, let that be a reminder how much local government really does matter. And so I really encourage young people or any people at all, but especially somebody who might have a little bit of an interest, either get involved in your city council. I've seen 3 people come in and move the needle on a local zoning issue. I've seen 5 people come in and change a local election, right? Reminder to everyone listening that you should get involved in local government, because sometimes it feels like the state house is just an adult daycare. No, I'm kidding. Local government is maybe the last frontier of where people can really come in and make a difference on issues that matter.
Local government and equal representation. Like, real representation is a key piece to this, too. Gretchen Whitmer was here a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. And just listening to the things that they've had done, because they have the perspective of men and women running their government, it's really impressive. It really is. Mm-hmm. Given that you are working in what must be a bang your head against the wall, pull your hair out job every day, body of government, how do you see work getting done? Do you find that you have to be the most creative person in putting things together? Is it like building friendships with people that don't agree with you? What do you do to get stuff done?
I'll be honest. As much as people hate this about politics, it is largely transactional. In other words, you build relationships and you build coalitions. And I always ask my constituents, especially my close Democratic friends and folks that I know are really active in the party, I always ask for grace, because sometimes I do support things because I'm trying to build relationships and trying to build political capital. And then, frankly, to get things done, you have to spend that political capital. So I'm always the one willing to sit down and rewrite a bill. There's a lot of debate about how many lawyers are too many up at the state house, but frankly, the background of going to law school makes me able, poised to sit down and say, hey, look, let's solve some constitutional issues with this bill. I will do the work. And you can build political capital that way, too. It doesn't always have to be votes and issues and things like that. You can do it by putting in the work and saying, hey, yeah, I will take the time to sit down and help rewrite this bill or compare these 2 versions. And I will work with staff to make sure that it's something that we can all live with. And putting in that work is also something I've tried to do so that people do see me as a credible operator up there. They know that I'm going to put in the work. And I don't just derive at conclusions lightly. I try to only speak out when I think I can either move the needle or because it absolutely has to be said, so that people do trust me and they do come to me and want to work together on issues that matter.
And to your point, not half, but 45 to 47% of your district voted against you. So they believe what your Republican colleagues believe, and yet you are their representative. So you have to represent them in some way that acknowledges them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are times where there may be an issue that I know that there are people in my district that don't agree with me on. So maybe I try to find a middle ground or a compromise, even though it's not exactly what I would have done. And we're representatives. It's a representative democracy. That's what we're supposed to do.
That's right. How much do you think the presidential election will affect the down ballot races? I think we're going to have a huge turnout.
Honestly, compared to 2022, I think a lot of the problem was just Democrats not voting or not coming out. And so I do think that the presidential turnout bump will help a lot of the down ballot races, to be honest. Maybe not all of them, because there will be just an equal amount of turnout on the Republican side for people passionate about Trump.
Yeah, totally.
But to the extent that we have seats that lean Democratic or things like that, that just we just didn't put in the work, I actually think presidential turnout will help a lot.
We didn't run 45% of our races for the same house 2 years ago.
If we had unlimited resources, I know we would do more. I do think that there is some good in focusing on where you can win. And I actually think that putting somebody in just for the sake of it, unless that person is definitely a credible messenger for the party, I don't know that we're doing ourselves any favors just by putting someone in for the sake of it. So I think they're doing amazing work up in Greenville and Spartanburg. I know you've had Catherine Harvey on your podcast, just really focusing on strategic races. And I think especially in races where maybe a longtime Republican or somebody that's seen as more moderate or electable if they lose to a Freedom Caucus person, all of a sudden that Democrat race might really be in play. So I do think being strategic about it is important. I do think the turnout overall will help us, especially in these Democratic-leaning seats that we probably shouldn't have lost in the first place.
So unlike in the U.S. House of Representatives that has been like the least effective at getting anything done, our state house has actually done a ton this year, right? You guys, there are lots of bills have passed. All kinds of things have come through this session. But it's so much that I actually would love to have you come back on once the session is over. And we can talk through the good, the bad, the ugly, and what to look forward to in the next session.
I think that'd be awesome. Let's do it.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us today, Spencer. I love having you on. And that's all the stew for today.
Put my heart, yeah, my heart belongs to South Carolina.
Frogmore Stew Podcast is written and hosted by Grace Cowan. Editing and IT support by Eric Johnson. Produced by TJ Phillips with the Podcast Solutions Network.